A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello everyone, fellow time travellers. I've elected to interview another fascinating, inspirational person full of information and insight. I'll say right off the top this moment that if I was a character in A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh, I'd be Eeyore. I'm an Eeyore-ish person. I'm pessimistic by nature. And fortunately, I'm married to somebody who's optimistic by nature, and she carries me along. But my life is punctuated by moments when I feel desperate need of contact with someone that I hope each time can lift my head up and encourage me to look towards the sunlit uplands. You know, because left to my own devices. I tend to look towards shadows, and I'm aware that that's not entirely healthy for a person. So, with that in mind, I came up with today's guest, Dr. Ahmed Malik. Now, he and I met. We were introduced by a mutual friend, a dear friend, and we met for the first time in a restaurant in London, and we just clicked. You know, just one of those ways. We're both Scottish people brought up in the west of Scotland. Ahmed's a bit younger than me. But, you know, we had a kind of a bits of background in common, which all obviously oils the wheels of conversation. And we've stayed in touch ever since. Ahmed's had a long story of during the last 4 years, as have we all, but he's had his own road to walk, his own furrow to plough. And we'll certainly get into a bit of that. But really, as I say, as an Eeyore, I know that Ahmed has had time to take a big picture view, a helicopter view of the things that are going on. And he's evolving a better way of looking at health and the mental attitude to, you know, how we approach life. So let's get into it. Good morning to you, Dr. Ahmed Malik.
Good morning. That's great introduction. Do you know what I'm looking at your beard, actually. I'm looking at your beard and thinking, why did I shave? I actually grew my beard out, and I'm just thinking, I look like a brown Malteser. I just look like a polished brown ball. And I think...
You're very smooth. But I was saying to my wife, I might never shave again. Whoa. Now that I've gone bearded for as long, I may never expose my chin to the elements again.
Wow. So what do you think of this theory? So some people say, because I've shaved off all my hair and it's bald up here, I should grow out the beard. You should have one or the other. So you and I are both actually the same, because you've grown out your hair and the beard, and maybe it should be one or the other.
Well, do you know, I was clean shaven for all my life. I've had, you know, period. You know how sometimes you just think, oh, I'll think I'll grow a goatee, yeah. See what it looks like. You know, experiments that don't last very long. But during the first lockdown, I grew a goatee for something to do. It was one of my little side hobbies.
I can imagine with the goatee, I think you'd be like an Alfonso or Ricardo, you know, one of these medieval yes. Spanish aristocrats. I can picture that.
With
the collar. You know, the goatee, the collar, the tights.
Maybe a ruff. I could wear a ruff, like someone from the Spanish Armada.
That's it. So,
Ahmed, this is exactly what I was after. You see, I knew you would lift my spirits, and you have done already. But just for you know, I'm sure many people will be familiar with your face. like a polished Malteser, as it may or may not be, as you say. But there'll be, but many people on my, maybe in my audience, might not have run across you yet. Just give us. I know we've got only a certain amount of time, and your story is a long and convoluted one with many twists and turns. But I thought maybe you could just give us the headlines of exactly what it is that unfolded for you during the last 4 years that would begin to explain why you and I are now chums.
I promise you I will. But first of all, I just want to say I think you're a much better husband than I am, because last week my wife Kat turned around and said, "Leave the beard. The only opinion that matters is mine." And I still went ahead and
what did you do?
So I'm going to grow this out. You're going to notice now. I'm going to have a bit of a, you know, trimmed beard. I'm going to do it.
Good. I'll keep anyway, tabs on that.
Yeah, because I'm learning from you as well. You're a much better husband than me. Anyway, so what about me? God, I was a very normie life orthopedic surgeon, and COVID hit. Just before that, Brexit. I mean, we've just had some weird times, you know. Every single time we say, God, the world is getting very polarized, it just gets even more polarized. Just when you think it couldn't get any more polarized. And COVID came about, you know, and I'm this orthopedic surgeon who's very disillusioned with the NHS. I was in the NHS for, you know, over 20 years, and it just didn't make sense to me where we were going, the trajectory, the deterioration, the decline. And it was a lie. It was not about keeping people sick, healthy. It was about just keeping people sick and dependent.
Were you already thinking like that before the, let's say, the medical interventions came trundling along towards us?
Yeah. This is like from like 2012 onwards. You know, I'm a consultant, and now, you know, when you're a junior doctor, you're just basically the hamster in the hamster wheel. You know, you're trying to beat off the competition. You're trying to get to that prize, which is to be a consultant. It's like, so you don't really pay much attention to anything else, and even for med school you just go through exam after exam, learn this, learn that. But it's only when with hindsight you look back and go, God, med school was really funny. That was a bit weird. We didn't get taught really a lot of important things like nutrition, like diet, like sleep, like how to exercise, or even one lecture on physiotherapy, or what's in a vaccine, or anything about a vaccine, or anything like that. We weren't taught anything about the history of medicine and how we've really done some crazy stuff in the past, like sticking needles up people's brains and scrambling them, or giving them arsenic and mercury for a cold and a flu, you know, stuff like that. We didn't get taught anything. We got taught, you're amazing, you're the top of society, the cream of society. Things go wrong. We don't know why. Here's a drug and here's a tablet. Here's an operation. We just kind of accepted it. But I was questioning, thinking, why did these things happen? Why do people get rheumatoid arthritis? You know, I just got off the phone with someone called Michael Rosen, who's going to be a guest in my podcast, who had scoliosis. And he wants to talk about why he got it, he thinks, and how you can treat it. And it was fascinating because, again, as an orthopedic surgeon, scoliosis is a big thing, straightening the spine. You know, you don't get taught, why do you get scoliosis? We never get told why. It's always like, oh, we don't know. Or even better, it's your fault, it's in your genes. So the whole medical paradigm is a bit strange, but you don't really question it because you're forced into this little narrow vision of exams, career, hurdle, jump through, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so you get to the point where you're a consultant, and now suddenly you got a little bit of breathing space. There is no rat race. There are no more exams. And you're now getting in touch with the managers, and now as head of the department, and you're getting to go to the meetings, and you're listening to the conversations, and it's like Orwellian doublespeak. You know, we will put patients at the center of care, and then the whole meeting is about how we are going to get patients off the waiting list and deny them treatment and care and save money. And I'm like, this is complete inversion of what we're meant to be doing. And it just went on like that. So I got really disillusioned with the NHS. I realized that it wasn't free anymore. It was actually taxpayers' money and a lot of it. I realized that it's not strapped for cash. It's actually rolling around in cash. It's the ultimate cash cow for corporations. And it's just a vehicle of extracting wealth from us and giving it to Big Pharma. And consultancy firms. And I was really upset because in that process of about 2016, 2017, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. He's dying of cancer. And that's when I had my wake up call. You know, my dad was like, look at you. You're fat. You're overweight. You're hypertensive. You're diabetic, son. You work 6 days a week. You don't know your wife or your kids. What are you doing? I'm a dying man. Sort your shit out. And I was like, wow. Yeah. And, you know, typical Glaswegian straight talking. And I was like, yeah, what am I doing? I am overweight and I've got a fatty liver and I'm diabetic and my doctor's telling me to take metformin. And
you're a consultant surgeon. You should know better.
Right? But you know, the diabetologist himself is overweight, is himself on metformin and eating donuts. You know, what I'm trying to say is people have this idea of doctors being on the pedestal and being the fountain of knowledge and being so smart. We're really quite dumb. And you just need to go to a local hospital and look at the average doctor and nurse. They're overweight. They're not healthy. They look stressed. And I was thinking about this. Actually, how can I be telling people about how to be fit and healthy when I'm not walking the walk? And then I was like, but I don't know how to, because everything I've been told I'm doing, you know, low fat, minimize meat, and you know, cut out the fat milk and the butter and all that kind of stuff, and I exercise, I'm at the gym and I'm on the treadmill. Why am I like this? What is wrong with me? I'm doing everything they tell me to do. And that's when I think the big realization and shock for me was that actually so much of what we're taught and told, public and the doctors, is wrong. And then actually when I started turning my health around and my wife and I lost a ton of weight and I reversed my diabetes, my hypertension, my fatty liver, my testosterone, which was rock bottom, is now back to normal. You know, I feel stronger now than at any point in my life. You know, if you ask me as a 18-year-old to run 10K cross country, I would have laughed at you. Now I can do it without any bother at all. And after this, you know, if you look, I've got my rash guard on. I'm off to do a jiu-jitsu class. That's why I need to go at 12, because I have to. It's my weekly session with the wife, couples therapy, where we try and strangle each other. You know, I've discovered what it means to be healthy and how it is to be healthy. And you know what the crazy thing is? I'm teaching this to my 5-year-old son. So then you think, well, if I can teach this to my 5-year-old son, we could teach this to all 5-year-olds in the country, and this would ensure that the whole nation would be healthy, strong, fit. Why are they not doing that?
Ahmed, had you had this Damascene moment before any of the, you know what you and I have both kind of come to categorize as the madness of the last, you know, since about whatever, 2019, 2020, the madness that seemed to envelop everyone on planet Earth.
Yeah.
So by the time that happened, you had already had the, I'm overweight, I've got diabetes, I've got a fatty liver, I should be doing something. So you were already on that path.
Yep.
For your own personal reasons before global events began to play.
Yep. 100%. 100%. And then the more I looked into it, the more I saw the corruption and the failings. So I realized that medical school training was actually just indoctrination. I realized that Big Pharma had this incredibly unhealthy influence on the medical profession. I've been involved in research and I've seen it firsthand. And at the time, I thought it was just localized. Professors, you know, look, let's just be honest. They were just lying about figures. So there's, for example, I would do a telephone call to patients who'd had surgery, and I would score them based on the answers. So you got a score out of 100. And if you were 18 above, that meant you were a good result, excellent result. And if it was 70 and above, it was a good result. And, you know, it goes down and down and down. And when I told the professor the results of this study and how they weren't that great, and I left and moved on to another job, I then was surprised when I saw the paper was published without my name on it. And what they had done was, you know, they had just moved the score chart so that now instead of being 18 above to get excellent, you just needed to be 16 above to get excellent, and so on and so on. So yes, the scores were still the same, but now the category was shifted, and suddenly they were like, oh, this operation has excellent 5-year results. And And my name was not in the paper.
So not terribly unlike the way in which the ONS have recently applied new maths to how they calculate excess deaths. And lo and behold, it turns out, oh, there's nothing to worry about there at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's just a lot of creative algorithmic manipulation of numbers.
Yeah, I call it statistical jugglery. You know, it's just, and they just, you know, and sleight of hand and this and that. And, you know, statistics is a great tool to deceive and misinform. You know, it's a very powerful tool, but along with things like modeling, you know, if you put garbage in, you get garbage out. So, and there was not just that one instance. You know, I saw how big pharma and companies were influencing people, funding trips abroad. You know, it goes on and on. And then I also saw how, you know, people would make a name for themselves promoting a certain procedure or drug or intervention. Their whole existence, you know, was based on that. And a lot of people build this idea of research, publications, and being an authority figure so they can get private practice. So people come to them for their medical reports, so they're the expert witness, and people seek them out, and they charge a fortune. So a lot of it is driven by money, ego, reputation. And big pharma influences now medical journals, meetings, associations, and governments now. The corruption is quite massive, and I think people don't really understand. But I saw that. I saw that. And what I was really upset about was the fact that I had managers telling me how to practice. So one of the things that I remember as a junior doctor was one of my professors who was almost close to retirement saying, "Ahmed, you know, the managers, be wary of the managers. They're trying to take away our autonomy. We are surgeons. You know, we are not just technicians, Ahmed. We decide, we think, you know, we plan, and never let anyone take that away from you. Otherwise, they will make you little monkey technicians. Anyone can operate. You can train a monkey to do an operation. We aren't monkeys. We are surgeons because we think. And I'll never forget that conversation, all right, at the Glasgow Western Infirmary. But that's exactly what happens. You know, the managers and the guidelines and the protocols have made all doctors, not just surgeons, into little monkey technicians. And they just follow the orders. They follow the protocols. I had this GP, this retired GP, Rachel, tell me, you know, at a meeting where I was giving a talk, "You're absolutely right, Ahmed. I've just retired." And she goes, "You know, when a patient is ready to come into my room, I get a little pop-up on my window just before I call the patient in. And the pop-up comes up, 'This patient is not on statins. Make sure they're prescribed on statins.' Pop up again. Oh, make sure this patient's on a proton pump inhibitor. Pop up. Make sure this patient's on an ACE inhibitor." And she goes, "I don't even know why this patient's coming in to see me, but I have to make sure by the time they leave, they're on these drugs. And if I don't give them these drugs, then I'm not hitting my targets. If I'm not hitting my targets, the practice doesn't make money. My partners call me up and my partners say, 'Why are you not prescribing these drugs? Why are you not hitting the targets? We're all losing money as a practice because of you.' So there's pressure, peer pressure, to comply and just give the goddamn tablet. I mean, what the hell? Just a tablet. And if you don't, the next step is you start getting referred for investigations. Like, you know, your practice is a bit unusual. You're not doing what everybody else is doing, Rachel. You know, you're not prescribing it. You know, you're missing the diagnosis. Do you need some retraining?" So you kind of get herded and funneled into just doing what everyone else is doing. And why are they going on statins? I mean, that's a complete nonsense. Cholesterol is life. It's the brick of life, your building block of your body. But you know what? Get rid of cholesterol. And what people don't realize also is cholesterol is it is literally the building block. So it then goes into lots of other things, hormones, sex hormones, cell membranes, you name it. So when you block that cholesterol statin, that statin thing, it blocks everything downstream, which is why you then get the plethora of side effects and complications. And so the whole paradigm of, oh, cholesterol is bad, is just complete nonsense. It's garbage. It's not science. But big pharma and the medical profession has sold it to you and everyone. And we've all been brainwashed into thinking that's the right thing. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You got PPE, PPIs, I mean, and antidepressants and vaccines and God knows what else.
Just to excavate a little into some of the background or the history of what you're saying, what effect was all of this having on you? I mean, let me assure you, I will get away from my Eeyore-ish tendencies. But first of all, I think I know because you and I have spoken and confided in one another, and I just because of your because of what you are and who you are, a consultant surgeon, which, as you say, is a kind of figure that people definitely hold in high regard, and you know, as a pillar of the of society and of the community. But I'm very interested to know what your awakening and your realizations that you're describing, what was that doing to you in your life?
Okay, I'm going to be honest, and it sounds terrible when I hear it, but this little brown mole teaser was just worried about himself and his family and just staying happy. I wasn't happy in the NHS. I found it very stressful. All the targets, the lack of autonomy, and I just wanted to be happy. I wanted to be healthy. So I left the NHS so I could get control back and treat patients the way I would treat my family. And that's all I cared about. I wanted to treat patients like my family. And I loved my job. Loved my job. I loved fixing ankle fractures and helping people. But actually, as I got healthier myself, my practice changed. So I found that actually I could avoid surgery in so many cases. I was only operating on 5% of patients in the last few years, because actually now, instead of saying, oh, so tell me about your ankle pain, I'd start off with, tell me about your sleep. Do you have much stress in your life? What's your diet like? What's your nutrition like? You know, and then tell me about your ankle. And I realized that everything was linked. Everything was linked. Because guess what? If you have chronic sleep deprivation and poor sleep, you don't heal, you don't recover, you have higher pain. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, we've all got aches and pains and bits of degeneration, but why is it some people do just fine with that degeneration and some people don't? And I've been through my fair share. You know, I've had 2 spinal surgeries, emergency spinal surgeries, I've had wrist operations. I've lived with chronic pain for 10 years. I've been on opioids. I know the whole shebang. So anyway, I started treating patients like how I recovered, and I saw my patients getting really well, doing well. And there's no bigger buzz, Neil. You know, when a patient texts you, and I'm still getting them now, although it's now tinted with a bit of sadness, when I get a message saying, oh, Ahmed, it says years since you operated on me, and look at me, I just ran this race, and I got this medal, and thank you so much, and I love you so much, I'll never forget you, and I'll always be grateful to you. Waking up to that kind of message, oh, you feel like a superhero. It's just amazing. So I left and went private, and I was really happy because I was now working 2.5-3 days a week. I was earning enough to have a comfortable life, not a rich life, but a comfortable one. My kids go to state school. We have secondhand cars. You know, we don't have a lavish lifestyle, small cottage. And I was happy with that. And I realized that's the pursuit of happiness, is being content and not wanting more and more. Because all my colleagues want the big house and the big cars and the private schools and the flash holidays. I mean, last year someone told me they went to the Maldives and, you know, spent £25,000 on a holiday, and I almost choked to death. I was like, what? You know, I mean, but if you're going to have that lifestyle, you need to generate the work and you need to convert the patients and then the stress that comes with that. So for me, I was really happy. I was not an activist. I did not want to be in the public eye. I didn't want to be going saving the world. I just wanted to do what I could do, which is treat patients the way I would treat my family. And then we went into COVID.
And then the world turned on its axis, or moved on its axis.
Yeah.
And what was it that you said? I mean, you know, what was the door that you opened one day that changed the way your profession perceived and treated you? What did you do? How did you cause it to change?
I think it goes back to when I was actually a consultant. I wasn't happy. You know, I went in there to get rid of the waiting list, and within a few months, one of the senior consultants came up to me in my office, shut the door, said, Ahmed, you know, what are you doing? I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, Ahmed, you know, you're working crazy. You're doing these parallel lists. Do you know what parallel list is? No? Okay. So, you know, normally surgeons go into an operating theater. The anesthetist spends anywhere from 30 minutes to 1 hour anesthetizing the patient. And that's all down to how good the anesthetist is. A lot of them are not very good. Can't find the cannula in the blood vessel, stressed, faffing around. People don't realize. The grade makes a huge difference, the expertise of someone. So you could, you know, if they're doing a spinal or a block, it could be spending ages because they're not very good. They're technically not very good. So you, as a surgeon, you could be waiting an hour for the patient to just simply come into the operating theater from the anesthetic room. Then when they get into the operating theater, you have to prepare the patient, clean them, drape them, and start the operation. And again, if you're not careful, that could take another half an hour. The operation itself is only maybe half an hour to an hour. And then you close up, and then they have to clean the theater, and that takes another half an hour to an hour, depending on who's doing it. Then you get them to send for the patient, depending on the porter and how fast they're walking. That could take God knows how long. And then the whole thing starts all over again. So the downtime as a surgeon is massive, you know, and a lot of the doctors will go to the coffee room, and the doctors, you know, will do their private practice, you know, correspondence, letters, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't. What I came up with was, look, when I start closing the wound, my junior can take over, and I'm going to go next door to the other theater where the anesthetist has taken an hour to get the patient to sleep and the patient's now ready. I will walk in, do the operation. And while I'm doing that, they're getting my patient out, cleaning the theater, bringing in the next one. And by the time I finish the second operation, I can walk back into the first theater and the patient's ready for me. And so I would go backwards and forwards. And I had two anesthetists, two theater teams, and I was churning out the work. 10, 12 operations in a day. Like, and the waiting list. But then my colleague came in and went, what are you doing? I went, what are you talking about? He goes, well, why are you working so hard? I was like, I'm getting rid of the waiting list. He went, no, I'm a junior. You're doing this all wrong. You're doing this all back to front. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, you're gonna overwork yourself. You're gonna just burn out. Look, you keep a waiting list so you can have leverage over the managers, and you build up enough waiting lists, and then people will come to you in the private sector, and those that can't pay for you, the managers will send to the private hospitals and pay you to operate on them over there. Everyone's happy. You're just disrupting the way things are done. And you're making us all look bad because we are not doing what you're doing. And I was like, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Is this how it works? And I could say much more, but I don't want to. It gets quite dark. I don't want you to get in a dark mood.
One way or another, you are not in that world anymore. That whole, you know, your evolution has taken you from the world of consultant surgeon to a completely different place.
Yep. Yeah. I don't think, I definitely jumped before I was pushed. There were obviously the world around me was closing in. But I think what it was is you cannot be in the system while criticizing it and exposing all the flaws and lies. The people in that system will not tolerate it because you're casting them in a bad light. So sooner or later, you're going to have to either exit or be pushed out. So that's what happened. So yeah, I'm very upset with my medical profession and colleagues, because going back to the last few crazy years, I think we've seen how medical ethics have been completely demolished. But the reality is it wasn't the last few years that did it. All the last few years did, Neil, was expose what was already there. People today are not really getting informed consent. People today don't have bodily autonomy. People today are being misled by doctors who don't actually say the oath. I never said the Hippocratic Oath. I never went through university and had to say that. And this whole premise of first do no harm is a complete nonsense. It's nonsensical. You know, I'll read it out to you. Let me just minimize this window. So this is a clip of what I was saying on the James Dellingpod podcast. And one of my listeners printed it out and did a meme. So when they being the doctors, when they say first do no harm, what they actually mean is do no harm to my license. Do no harm to my income. I better do no harm to my reputation. Oh God, no. Do no harm to my standing in the community. Do no harm to my career. Do no harm to my mistress. Do no harm to my holidays. Do no harm to my kids' private schooling. And maybe, Maybe then, if it comes down to it, do no harm to my patients, but only if I'm sticking to the guidelines. That's what's the reality of the situation we live in today.
Which, you know, I mean, as a consumer of that product, which is the NHS, that's harrowing to listen to. I mean, obviously, over the last few years, via conversations with yourself and others, I've more than had the curtain drawn back. I mean, you know what you're saying now is I've heard some of this, you know, from you and from others. I'm well aware. But what I want to get to is, you know, you mentioned earlier that you had already evolved a situation where you were only actually surgically you were only operating on 5%. So that 95% of the people that you were helping in ways that were non-surgical. Mm. And what I'm interested in is, clearly now, because of where you find yourself and the circumstances in which you have put yourself, because as you say, you know, you jumped or walked rather than wait to be pushed and so on. You've evolved that 95% means of helping people, healing people, or making people healthy in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's the bright light towards which I would like to walk. You know,
100%.
What is that holism that you have understood and that you're now offering?
Yeah, 100%. Let's do that. And you know, I've got a book in my head that I need to write and get published, and it's gonna happen. Doc Malik's Simple Guide to Good Health. And if anyone doubts me just about what I'm saying, just quickly let me touch on this. Neil, how many doctors do you think are in the UK registered with the GMC, roughly?
Oh, do you mean general practitioners, or do you mean everyone who holds some sort of license to...
Every doctor who's got a license.
I would imagine tens of thousands.
Something like 370,000. Now, with 370,000 people,
370,000. Wow!
Just Google it. Just Google it. Google how many people are registered with the GMC. I mean, some might not be working. Some might be in pharma. Some might be this. Some of that. But you know, anyway, something like 370,000. It's quite a lot. Would you say it's a lot?
That sounds like, yes. That's like an order of magnitude up from what I was expecting would be the answer. I've never contemplated that question before.
Yeah, well, if you imagine like 300, let's make it 350,000, right? Imagine you've got 350,000 doctors. You'd imagine there'd be quite a wide variety of thoughts, opinions, and beliefs in that group, yes?
Yes.
Quite significant. Definitely. Even if there is a minority, that minority view would still be probably in the tens of thousands?
Yes, I would expect to hear a range of opinions about how things ought to be.
Right. So now think about how many doctors do you know in the UK who have spoken against the official government narrative regarding the last few years?
Well, I'm in a very, very almost unique situation. I mean, as you know, I mean, I take part in spaces on social media, Twitter spaces and so on, which specifically attract contrary dissenting voices. So I'm hearing,
we're talking
I'm hearing
about
from
10.
An absurd amount. Oh, I know, but yeah, we're talking even about, at that, as I say, a handful of people, which will be many handful. More dissenting voices than the vast majority of people have heard.
Yeah, so we're talking about, in the UK only, UK doctors, we're talking about less than 10, somewhere between 5 and 10.
Oh, yeah.
Who are going against the official government narrative and speaking publicly. Now, with the whole laws of probability, that's impossible. You cannot have that small a number of people disagreeing out of 350,000, 370,000 people. That means that there is a sizable chunk of people who also agree with what we are saying, but are not saying it. Then that begs the question, why are they not saying it? And I'll tell you why. Because of that first do no harm. They're too scared to say something because they know what will happen to them. They will either get referred to the GMC, struck off, or lose their job or their practicing privileges like moi. So to preserve their income and their career, they have chosen to stay quiet and ignore the central tenet of medical ethics, which is to do first do no harm. So the next time you go and see a doctor in A&E or in the GP practice or the minor injuries unit, how in you know, full confidence do you know when they are advising you or your child or your parent about a certain course of action, they're actually recommending what's in your best interest and not actually what's in their best interest, which will protect their license and their income. Because it could be that what is in your best interest will get them into trouble. And if it gets them into trouble, then they're not going to be happy. So they might say, well, I'll just go along and do as I'm told because the guidelines tell me to. And the reality is, if you get sick or die, you know, through a protocol or a guideline, no doctor will get pulled up for that. The doctor will be protected. But the moment a doctor does something for you and actually something happens to you and it was outside the guideline, the whole weight of the machinery will come down on that doctor and punish them and say, that's because of you, that's your fault, and make an example of you. So this is terrifying where we are right now. And it doesn't matter if you're private or NHS, it's the same thing. Anyway, let's go back to health then. So the simple things that, you know, I would say is when someone dangles to you a device or supplements or some expensive modality, run the other direction. So I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling any machines, any treatments or any supplements. You know, yes, there are things that can help you, and I take supplements, but you don't supplement yourself out of bad health, just like you don't comply out of tyranny. I just had to get that in. So basically, the things that I'm telling you are free. They're free. They're cheap. They're simple. But they do take personal responsibility and sometimes sacrifice and effort. And the problem is that human beings have become lazy and they want a quick fix, and they've abdicated their personal responsibility to authorities that care not about their health. And so that's where we need to change as a culture. We need to stop going for the easy route. We need to choose the harder route, the harder path, because that's where the real fruit lie. So anyway, I would say, first of all, sleep. So underestimated the power of sleep, you know. But we talk about beauty sleep, for example. If you just look at night shift workers, people who do night shifts live a good 10 years less than people who don't do night shifts. They have a much higher rate of cardiovascular disease, angina, heart attacks, strokes, and a much higher incidence of cancer. So just think about that. Something is happening to these people when they're doing night shifts. They're dying quicker and they're sicker. And it's not just about life expectancy. You know, you could live to 80, but you could spend 15 years, you know, incontinent, doubly incontinent in a nursing home, not knowing who you are, where you are. Do you really want to live 15 years like that? So I think people need to understand that's not just about, you know, longevity. It's about the quality of life that you have. So sleep deprivation is a major problem, and it's essentially because it's during sleep that you actually heal, recover, repair, and build. It's not when you're in the gym lifting those weights that you're going to be building muscle mass.
I am not good at sleep. Do you know, okay. I'm seeking some professional help. when I was younger, but actually before I had children, I was great at sleeping. And I mean, mm-hmm. I've had jobs in my pre-child existence, which were stressful for whatever reason, but I was always able to come home. And if I'd had a really bad day for whatever reason, my refuge was sleep. You know, whatever stress I was experiencing did not keep me awake. You know, sometimes I would come in and I would think, I'm just going to my bed, and I would get 10 hours of sleep. I was uninterrupted sleep. I was really, well, it worked for me. Obviously, I've got three children. They're grown up now, largely. But ever since the first of them, that, you know, that classic, you know, it disrupts your sleep, obviously, because you're getting up through the night with an infant and so on and so on. And I never got it back. One way and another, my ability to sleep was sort of, that had been deleted. And I'm very aware. I know this. I know that, you know, it's a third of your life should be spent asleep, and it's where your soul and your your essence goes to recover and to process and to repair. I'm well aware of all of that, but I am not good at it. And I've tried it. I stay away from the light of computers. I don't drink caffeinated drinks late in the day and so on and so forth. I'm not good at it. And it worries me because I know how important sleep is.
Well, stop worrying about it because that's not going to help either. Worry creates stress. Stress, cortisol dampens everything. But you're right. Sleep is so important. And, you know, it's not just all the things we just touched upon. It's a much deeper scientific level. You know, you've got the circadian rhythm. Every cell in your body has a clock, and it, you know, at different times the clock goes ding, and then hormones are released. Certain hormones go up, certain hormones go down. If you don't sleep, then your insulin levels go up, then you put on weight. So just not sleeping will put weight on, make you insulin resistant. It will lower your testosterone. It will lower your muscle mass, your recovery, regeneration. So 100%. But I mean, like, why your sleep is not right, I mean, we could talk about this for hours. I mean, my simple thing I would say is a lot of people struggle. I struggle, Neil. You know, I'm not going to lie. It's a daily battle for me. I wake up probably once a night because I need to go for a wee-wee. I need to sort that out. But things like going to sleep early is really important. But waking up early is also equally important. You know, the habit of snoozing and hitting the alarm. You should get up at 6 every morning and go straight out and watch the sunrise, because that's when your circadian rhythm clock is reset. And that's really important.
Really? Early risers statistically do better than whatever, much night better. Owls or so on?
Much better. So get that fresh sun, dawn light in your eyes. Get some exercise done in the morning. Do some grounding. And grounding's not some woo-woo thing. You actually get electrons through the earth charging your system. It helps generate something called easy water, which is structured water, which is another fascinating conversation. It's called the fourth phase of water. Absolutely incredible. Not
I've never heard of this. Woo-woo. I don't know anything. You're saying this for the first time. I've never heard those words uttered before.
Yeah, we'll look into Gerald Pollack's work. It's absolutely fantastic. So water has memory. Water is a battery. Water is incredible. When, you know, when I slice a patient open, I've done it for years. You know, we're 70% water. Just think about it, 70% water. We're meant to be bags of water, right? So if I cut you open, you'd expect water to just gush out. Doesn't happen. Never happens. Water in the body is actually almost like a gel. Why? Why is that? How is that? How is that water structured that way? It's absolutely fascinating. Anyway, it needs electrons to make the easy water, and that's why grounding works. And that, there's a lot of other things that help with that. It's all on my podcast. So basically what I'm trying to say is sleep is very important. So wake up early, go to sleep early. And then, you know, if you keep doing that and don't have midday naps, you're going to be tired by third, fourth day and want to crawl into bed. Minimize the screen time, not just during the evening, but during the day. And, you know, the moment it starts to get a bit dark, 6, 7 o'clock, put your blue blocker glasses on. Dim the lights. Definitely stop watching screens like a good hour before you go to bed. Pick up a book. Do some meditation. Do some relaxation work. Have sex. And definitely avoid eating 3 hours before you go to bed. Because when you eat, a lot of people don't understand that it's actually turning all the machinery on. You're turning all the knobs, pulling all the levers, pressing all the buttons, and the machinery's getting back up and running and increasing the blood flow to the stomach and then drawing the nutrients out and taking to the liver, and the liver's a factory, and just imagine all the smoke's coming out the pipe. No, you don't want to be doing that. You want to be turning everything off, disengaging. So how many people do you know who eat late at night? A ton. They come home tired and then they get their food out, and what are they eating? They're eating garbage, processed, microwaved, whatever. And you're giving the wrong signals to your body. You're just firing everything up. You know, when we went out for that meal, it was late at night. Late at night.
It was dark o'clock in Londonshire.
Yeah, I don't do that. Don't do that. It's bad for you. So many of these dinners I go to, and I just drink sparkling water. People look at me like, and it's not just the fact that I fast and eat one meal a day now. It's just too late. It's too late. Just ruins me, wrecks me. And when you, the funny thing is, when you get to a healthy state, you don't need much to feel awful. But when you're awful, feel awful, you're always feeling awful. another little thing won't make you feel worse. And that's why when you start getting healthy and there's little incremental gains, it can be quite motivating because you're like, oh, wow, I feel so much better now. I'm gonna try, you know, changing a little bit of my practice here and a little bit of practice in my here. I mean, you know, we don't have time in this podcast, but I think the key thing is incremental gain. So very, very quickly, the things you want to optimize is your sleep, your diet, your nutrition, your fasting, your exercise, love in your life, nature in your life, connections, minimize stress, have clean water, healthy water, not tap water, you know, stuff like that. And we can go into the details another day.
Something you said there, I just need to echo it. Loving your life.
Mm.
I think one of the most pernicious elements in modern Western life is the way in which being with someone you love and someone who loves you is so undervalued. We don't talk about it. I'm married to Trudy. I've known Trudy most of my life. And she is so integral to my well-being. She makes me better. Whatever you mean by better, health, improved as a whatever. She makes me a better person. And we don't hear enough about that. You know, there's this sort of background noise of people thinking that, you know, multiple partners and or delaying being together with someone is there in the sort of mood music of our lives. And, you know, anyway, I could go on and on.
Lovely. Beautiful. I love the fact you're a big romantic. Yeah, great. 100%. So love for me is also with that other person just feeling really complete. And I have that and I'm very lucky. And I feel really sad because maybe it's just my exposure, but, you know, having met hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people through my work, I would say about 80% of couples are very dysfunctional, are marriages or relationships of convenience, and they don't really have love. And it makes me sad. It makes me very sad. And, you know, when I hear people say, I fell out of love, or we grew apart, I think that didn't have to happen. That could have been avoided. Have you ever come across love languages, by the way?
No.
Can we talk about it for a second?
Yeah, go for it. Absolutely.
Anyone who knows me knows I could talk for a while. Mate, you know us Glaswegians. We can blather. Anyway, so basically, love, I didn't know this until, you know, only a few years back. Love is not something you just think, oh, I love you and you love me and it's that simple. There's actually a language to love. And this great guy, whose name I've just forgotten, typical, broke it down into five different broad themes, five languages of love. And most people have one or two languages that they recognize. So they like to receive love in this manner, okay? Also, when you like to receive love in this manner, the default is you like to give love back in that manner to other people. But that's a pitfall people make. Because just because you like love being given to you in a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that the love that someone else is out there that you're giving back to is the way they want it. And that's where relationships get into trouble. You need to understand your partner's love languages. Because you may have different ones. And to be honest, the likelihood is that you do. Because opposites attract. So I'll give you an example. The main love languages are acts of service. So if you empty the dishwasher or cook a meal or clean up around the house or go out shopping, that's an act of service for someone else, potentially. If you take their clothes to the dry cleaning. If you words of affirmation. So if you're constantly messaging throughout the day or talking to each other, or even when you see them in the evening and say, I love you, baby, you're the best husband I could ever ask for. I love you so much. By the way, your hair is gorgeous. I'm so lucky to have you. You know, just saying nice things to you make you feel special and loved. Third one, gifts. Hey, Neil, I love you so much. Here's a aftershave I want to give you. You're like, oh my God, I feel so loved. Or a box of flowers or a box of chocolates or a bunch of flowers. So that's that. And then there's quality time. So Neil, you know, when I come and see you, I want to spend time with you, buddy. I want to spend some quality time chatting, talking, just doing shit together. And then the last one is physical touch. And it's not actually sex. It's about holding hands, sitting next to each other, stroking someone's hair, or my bald head, or whatever. So I'll give you an example. My wife's languages of love, predominantly the big one right up there at the top, was acts of service. So me cooking a meal for her, tidying up around the house, doing things with the kids, because we, you know, I went part-time, so I was helping with the kids and everything, would make her feel loved up. And she did. If I didn't, if I sat at home with my feet up and she comes home and goes, so what's for food? I'm like, I don't know. What are you going to cook? That would not make her feel loved up. So her language of love was acts of service, me doing things for her, which I was very naturally very good at. Her other language of love was physical touch. And one of the things my wife and I always do and have done for a very long time is, you know, whenever we spend a little bit of time watching TV, you know, before we start, we light a fire, we chat about the kids and work, and we massage each other. She sits in front of me, I do her shoulders, her head, then I sit in front of her, and then she does me, or then we do the feet sometimes, or the hands, and it's very relaxing, it's very tactile, it's very loving. It's a great thing we do together. So those were her two love languages, physical touch and acts of service. Now, what did she want to do to love me?
I love how you said earlier that you weren't a good husband because you shaved. And then you just list this behavior. I would say on the contrary, Ahmed, I think you're you sound like a very attentive and in the moment kind of a person, certainly. I think I knew you were being self-deprecating. However, I would say you're paying attention.
I am. I'll come to that in a second. So then, but the problem is with the whole lockdown and everything, there's a bit of a strain on our marriage. And I realized, this is before I understood love languages. The problem was my wife was giving me love the way she wanted to be received. And that was a mistake because my love language is not acts of service. If I wanted the house cleaned, I'd get a maid. If I wanted food, you know, I cook it myself. You know, I'm very self-sufficient. I'm very independent. I'm not a typical man who just sits with his feet up and, you know, clicks fingers. And I'm very hands-on. I'm very domesticated. And I like it like that. I love that. So I don't want my wife to do acts of service for me. It means nothing. Physical touch was great, but it wasn't enough. My main language of love is actually quality time. And one of the things my wife fell into, unfortunately, was an addiction. She was addicted to Pokemon. She got into this stupid game. Someone mentioned to it. She used to watch Pokemon as a kid, the cartoon. And when the game came out, someone told her about it, some friend. No, I'm being serious. She became addicted to the game Pokemon. She's on her phone the whole time. She's on the toilet for hours. I'm like, what are you doing? She's on Pokemon. We go to the park with the kids. And I'm pushing the swing. And I'm, where's my wife gone? And she's up there with her Pokemon trying to slay some monster. And it was quite bad. Quality time was not quality time with her. Her idea of then quality time was watch TV.
Your relationship was being undermined by Pokemon.
Yeah. No, I mean it. Seriously. And amongst other things, so like WhatsApp groups at work, you know, whenever it was on her phone, she was always on her phone, on Facebook or this and that. I was not having quality time with her. I wasn't chatting to her, talking to her. I was starting to get quite lonely. You know, she was there, but not there. And that's my main language of love, quality time. And when you do not get that love, you feel unloved. And then you feel resentment. Then you feel anger. And then you start to grow apart. That person doesn't love me. Why should I bother doing anything for them? I don't love them back. So imagine like you're walking down a path together in the woods, right? You're holding hands. Great. You're walking together. You know where you're going. You're coming back. Same destination together. But imagine you're not holding hands. Imagine you've got headphones on, you're listening to music. Imagine every step you take 1 millimeter apart. How many steps do you take in a day? 10,000? That's 10,000 millimeters apart. How many days in a year? And then suddenly, do you see how suddenly you've grown apart? And you're like, hey, where is my partner? Where are they? Oh my God, they're right over there. We grew apart. We fell out of love. And then to get that course correction, sometimes it's so violent, it's not possible. Sometimes it's just like, ah, God, you're too far away now. You're miles away. Do you know what? I see someone else here now. Bye-bye. And you go have an affair, you go wherever, blah, blah, blah. So comes back to what you said, you're very attentive. Like, when it comes to relationships, if you aren't working at it every single day, it ain't working. The moment you take your other half for granted, bingo, it's gone. Every day you should treat your other half as if it's your first ever date. You know, the butterflies in your stomach, the excitement of seeing them, yearning for their presence, looking forward to them. But not in a weird way, not in a weird now jealous way. I encourage my wife to go out with her friends and have dinner and do things with them. And she likes me to go out like tonight, early evening, I'm meeting a friend for a curry. You know, like it's good to spend time away, but you should be excited about being together and you should be working hard at it.
Did you just, I'm just watching the clock for us both. I'm just watching that. I know that you have you've got to go and have your jiu-jitsu session, but all of this that you're talking about here, what I'm saying is if the disruption of the last 4 years,
yeah,
and specifically really what happened in the first sort of 18 months, 2 years of that period, was it that set you off in so many ways in this voyage of discovery about yourself and about your relationship and all the rest of it, such that you might actually be able to say that in some ways you're glad it happened. I'll go first on that because I think, although in many ways if I could press a button and make the COVID debacle not have happened, I'd be severely tempted to press that button and have the COVID debacle not have happened to the world. But in reality, because of the understanding that I've acquired and the deepening of the way in which, you know, Trudy and I understand each other, which we were already great, but that has been even further intensified. And the people that parted company with me because they didn't like what I was thinking and saying, but the people that have come into that vacant space, including you, sometimes when I do an account of it all, I think, do you know, this was for my betterment.
Mate, 100%.
I'm more aware, paying more attention and thinking more deeply about important things than I did in the first half century of my life.
Yeah. Never have regrets. Mate, I've been molested as a kid, bullied as a child. I've been through a painful, abusive marriage. I've been paralyzed after a car accident. I've had emergency surgeries. I've been bullied and harassed at work. I've been hounded out of my profession, bullied and harassed by my private hospitals. I went through the whole COVID debacle. I've been called so many names and things. I don't care. I wouldn't take any of that back. I'd go through it all over again because I am who I am today because of all these experiences, and they've shaped me into the person that I am right now. And I quite like who I am right now. And I think it's always about taking the negatives in your life, and we all have them, and embracing them and turning what is adversity and negativity into positivity. That's our job. And there will always be shit in the world. And what I always say to people, and this is a good place to end, imagine you're in a hurdle race. You know, there's hurdles every kind of like 10, 20 meters. You know, there's a nice stretch in the middle and you get your legs stretched out, and then you have to go over the hurdle. Sometimes you trip over it and you stumble and then you have to pick yourself up and keep running. And you know, you have to keep going. Now, the only time there aren't any hurdles left is when you're no longer on the track. What I'm trying to say is life is that hurdle race, that track. It's just an inevitability. Enjoy the sweet moments in between. Jump over the hurdles, pick yourself up, keep going. The only time we're never going to have these problems is when we're dead. It's like, just accept it, embrace it.
Ahmed, I knew, as I said, I knew that you were going to lift me up. I knew you were going to lift my spirit, because there is something about you, and it's clearly you're a product of everything that has made you, and whatever it is, all that you just listed, has made you a bright, a positive force. And I'm delighted that our paths crossed when they did. And as I mean it, I want you to come back and talk to me and my audience regularly, because, you know, what you're prescribing as a healer is, you know, money can't buy it. So, Ahmed Malik.
My pleasure.
Former consultant surgeon, but really now a proper healer. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.